Friday.
Okay, well. But I.
Today is March 2nd, 2017. This is a Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services.
What are you doing over there, Senator?
This is a continuation of the public hearing on House Bill 5026 and 5027. But before we do that, Senator Winters would like to,
I have a request, yes.
Yes, a request, please.
Yesterday was a grand birthday.
Yes, it was.
Yesterday. So I think we should actually sing happy birthday this morning to our chair.
We should indeed. But don't you think we should wait till his senator is here?
Huh?
His senator's testifying. Don't you think we should sing to him when his senator's here and she can sing too?
Well, that's, I mean, if she wants,
we can always break it up
and have an added chorus. But I think right now, so I'd like to start. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Rayfield. Happy birthday to you and many more.
Until noon yesterday, which is why we had to postpone his birthday celebration.
Senator Winters, live from Hearing Room E. So she'll be here all week, folks. So with that.
The important business of the state is
not done. Yeah, the important business of the state is not done. Ms. Ames, is there anything else that we need to do before we begin? All right. Well, please continue.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Lillian Shirley, Public Health Director in the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you for letting us come before you today to discuss the budget of the Public Health Division. I have with me Dr. Katrina Hedberg, who is our Chief Science Office and Health Officer for the state, and Ms. Karen Slothauer, who is the Budget Director for the Public Health Division. So thank you. So just trying to sort out where we left off yesterday and what we have to do today. One of the things that Senator Co-Chair Steiner Haywood asked is that we could just go back to the tobacco KPM and then go through them and get to our budget slides. So this is one of our, after our discussion yesterday around obesity and chronic disease, tobacco is still the main cause of morbidity and mortality. You can trace it to a number of diseases that inflict Oregonians and affect their quality of life. So the work that we've done since the late 90s in tobacco has been significant in Oregon. And as you can see from the chart, the per capita cigarette pack, et cetera, since 1997 has significantly declined. Excuse me. And this has resulted in real healthcare savings as well as quality of life and saved lives for Oregonians across the state. Okay, and do you want to just talk a little bit about how we parse it out, you know, in terms of where we see differences in rates, and also I think it's really important for us to call out some of the threats that we're facing to the progress that we've seen over the past.
So, Co-Chair Steiner Haywood and Representative Rayfield, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, State Health Officer with the Public Health Division. And so, as Ms. Shirley said, we actually have seen some success with tobacco. This slide shows decrease in per capita sales. So, this is from tobacco tax. We also monitor the prevalence of use in adults. That has declined, but we're still at 17% of adults use. Now, one of our real concerns, we've seen declines among youth use of cigarettes. 11th grade prevalence is now at 9%. 8th grade is at 4%. This is having used cigarettes in the past month. But one of the real threats to this, of course, is e-cigarettes. And we've seen the use among our kids in middle and high school really increase dramatically. Currently, 11th grade e-cigarette use is 17%, and 8th grade use is 9%. Again, this is having used in the past month. So even though I like to say tobacco is a success, it remains the leading preventable cause of morbidity and mortality.
Next slide. And again, we had quite a bit of discussion yesterday around this issue and the impact, so I'm just going to move on. These are oral health. There's a lot of concern, as you know. We've been doing a lot of work, particularly with our with the Dental Association and our community partners and our CCOs around, addressing the issue of poor oral health, particularly in Oregon's children. And there has been a wonderful increase in the percent of sealants that children get in Oregon. And one of the drivers for that, we feel, is that the CCOs have accepted as one of their incentive measures having dental sealants as, for their covered lives and have really supported and worked with the schools in their regions to increase that. Next slide. So we also talked quite a bit about Oregon's problems with drug overdose and substance use and some of the activities that we've done to address that. And I'm just going to ask Dr. Hedberg to talk a little bit about some of what this actually means in terms of what we're seeing really what are the drivers that we're seeing that we want to address and in what priority from the data that we're looking at.
So thank you again, co-chairs and members of the committee. This slide, what we can see, actually, I look at this as also good news, but tempered. With prescription opioids, that's really has been one of our focus. And as you can see, that has leveled out in the late 2000s and has declined. And actually, we have some good news that in the fourth quarter of 2016, we also saw a decline in the number of prescriptions, particularly to folks under the age of 65. And that's important from our prescription drug monitoring. Again, we spoke at length about it yesterday. But it does not contain reasons for prescribing. So when we're looking at prescribing for chronic pain, it's good news that folks in the younger population are getting fewer opioids. The people over the age of 65, prescribing looks to be relatively flat in that group. But, of course, a number of those people may have cancer, end-of-life care, et cetera. So we aren't seeing quite the same impact. We are concerned, however, about not just prescription opioids, but other medications as well, or other drugs, I should say, heroin. Other states have seen that increase dramatically. We haven't seen that same increase in Oregon, but we also have not seen any decline in heroin deaths. And then that last line, the psychotropic or other psychoactive medications such as benzodiazepines, we've seen an increase in deaths related to those. It's a little bit difficult to parse out all of this because many of these people are using multiple drugs, and a particularly lethal combination is using opiates and the benzodiazepines at the same time. So the strategies around opiate overdose are actually, we have three big buckets. The first is preventing the number of medications, so preventing people from overdosing in the first place by limiting number of medications such as the prescribing guidelines that I think we spoke about yesterday, and other strategies really to increase alternative treatments for chronic pain and having those covered, and now Medicaid does cover alternative treatments for chronic back pain. So it's not that we want people to be in pain. We want to offer other treatments for them that are safer than opiates. And then the two other main strategies we have to prevent deaths, number one is naloxone, and that is a rescue medication that if people have overdosed, it prevents them from dying. And then the third category is increasing access to medication-assisted treatment for people who are addicted to opiates. Again, we want to be offering these in a humane manner, and I think we're starting to see some of the effects of that. It's a little bit too early to tell when you only see one quarter of decreased prescribing, and this is increase or the decline in deaths, but it remains to be seen. This is a challenge not in Oregon, not just in Oregon, but around the country, and so again, I'm hopeful that we're starting to turn the curve, but you can see we're still four times higher than we were back in 2000 when it comes to overdose deaths.
Next slide. Okay, so one of our other key performance measures is suicide deaths among Oregon residents. And we know, and we've known for quite a bit of time, that we rank very high across the nation. We're 13th in the number of suicide deaths in the nation. And it's been pretty consistent. You know, there's been a lot of activity around how to address it, excuse me, in communities, but it's a pretty persistent number. So in 2016, we've kind of changed our strategies in a couple ways. One is you're all aware of the behavioral health work and the behavioral health collaborative work that has been done through the Oregon Health Authority. And our work, both in surveying not only what is happening with suicide deaths, but also attempts, age breakdowns of where these things are happening and to whom, and what are the methods that result in a successful suicide attempt. And we're working very closely with the Suicide Alliance, which is a community-based group of not just providers, but community survivors, as well as not-for-profits and our behavioral health partners, to really come up with a statewide approach that includes all sectors. And it's based on the brand name kind of for it is Zero Suicide. And it's a nationally recognized model. It's evidence-based. And in states where it has been implemented, in regions of the country, local regions of the country, they've seen a significant controlling of the number of suicides, both the preventing people from attempting and also in making sure that people who attempt do not necessarily complete. So,
yes,
do you? Thank you, Chair Birthday Boy. have you been collecting the data in sufficient enough to have an age breakdown and a racial breakdown?
Yes, so co-chair Senator Winter, absolutely. We can provide you much more data on suicide. It turns out that the highest rates of suicide, they increase with age. So we hear a lot in the news, and of course it's very tragic when it's young people who die, but the highest rate of suicide is actually in older men and primarily white men. So again, we've looked at this specifically. In that category, some of them have you know, potentially been widowed or living alone, et cetera, and some of that social isolation, but that is the highest group. Another group that's at very high risk for suicide is our veterans, and so that's another group that we are very interested in working with people at the VA to help address, again, through PTSD, other things that happen when veterans return. Yeah.
We've got Representative Bueller.
I think.
Please.
Thank you. Just really quick, it would actually be helpful to the community, Dr. Hedberg, if you could provide a little bit of a breakdown on these statistics by population, mm-hmm. age, mm-hmm. demographic, mm-hmm. whatever, because I think this is a different issue that you can't really target. I mean, just as you said yesterday, you'd love to have the obesity data by zip code. We know mm-hmm. more about suicide than is obvious in a total of per capita
yeah.
numbers.
Yeah. So, Senator Steiner-Hayward, thank you. Would you like that specifically for suicide? Or, I mean, in each one of our indicators that we're presenting today, we have, I can give you a book, but I could also give you the two or three pages that have more data about the statistics.
Yeah, two or three pages that have more data would be lovely for starters,
yes.
And then if we need more, we'll ask for it. How about
thank
that for
you? I'd be very happy to provide
thank you very
that.
Much.
We
appreciate
were trying to make sure this was short and sweet.
No,
but
this is
yes,
great for
you're
here, bringing, but it's clear yeah. this committee is interested in several
data.
Of these issues and so just want to make sure we have to dig down a little bit.
Absolutely.
And we'll make sure that we also include the links to where this, where all the data lives on our website. So, you know, we give you two or three pages. You can also delve more into
the
data.
Book.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, a similar question. I'd be very interested in the rate of suicide on college campuses.
Mm-hmm. So, co-chairs and Representative Euler. I'm not sure we have specifically about whether it's on campus or not. We can certainly tell you by age group, but we will look into that. We do have something in Oregon called the Violent Death Reporting System, and so we do a fair amount of investigation around each of our deaths, not just suicide, homicide as well. So I can try to answer that question. We may have the address of the person, but whether or not, I think that number on college campus is actually fairly low in the overall scheme, but I'll see what we can find.
And there may be some definitional problems there, because my understanding from constituents who have a particular concern about this is it's many times classified as an accident when it's on college campuses. So.
Yes, so co-chairs and Representative Buehler, I think one of the problems with suicide, it's actually true for a number of our statistics, we get it off death certificate, but you're absolutely right that depending on if someone leaves a suicide note, and then it's, I would say easy, but then you can classify it. If you have, for example, a single car crash in the middle of the night, it's hard to tell whether it was intentional or whether it was accidental, someone fell asleep. So similarly, there are a number of things that go into this. Our violent death reporting system, the investigation, includes information that we get from the medical examiners, from the police, et cetera, to try to understand what the larger circumstances are surrounding it. So again, I'll try to get you those data, but you're absolutely right. When it's a single event and someone, again, dies by gun, sometimes it's hard to tell whether that was a suicide or an accidental death. And I guess the same would be true for a drug overdose, as another example. If people are taking them, were they taking the drug in order to get high, if you will, and then died, or were they actually trying to end their lives by taking too much, of a drug? So you're absolutely right.
And to follow this line, how much are you seeing of the overdoses in Oregon related to fentanyl?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chairs Representative Buehler. The fentanyl issue, so fentanyl, for other members of the committee, is a very strong opiate. There is prescription or pharmaceutical fentanyl that has been used both for end-of-life care, and it's a very strong short-acting. Other parts of the country have seen increase in fentanyl overdose. It's synthetic or it's illicit opiate fentanyl, much of it imported from China. And then what happens is that they're often cutting other drugs that they think they're taking, like cocaine or heroin, with this fentanyl, and they end up dying very quickly. There have been large clusters that have been seen in the East Coast. Most recently, there was one in New Haven, in Connecticut, that was published in the MMWR. In Oregon, we have seen some fentanyl deaths. I can get you the exact number of those overdose. And we do have those on our website. Again, we'll send you the link so that everyone can see the exact number. I think there may have been something like 6 or 7 in that area. We do know that our neighbors to the north, not so much Washington, but British Columbia, has had a very big problem with deaths from illicit fentanyl that have been, again, come in most likely from overseas, that are people may be either intentionally using the fentanyl because they think they can get really high, or it may be that they are doing it without their knowledge. They think they're getting heroin or methamphetamine or cocaine or something like that, and then it's been cut with fentanyl and they end up dying.
Please. Yep. So the fentanyl is not being manufactured, from your knowledge, in country.
To my knowledge, the fentanyl that we're seeing, this illicit fentanyl, has been manufactured overseas. There is a big national effort looking at this. So our high drug traffic, or what are they called? drug trafficking. We work with them. HIDA, high intensity drug trafficking. Thank you. I know the acronym better than yes. So have been working on it. So law enforcement is very aware, and actually, Congress is also very interested in sort of prohibiting imports of any of these drugs. They're illicit, but then they can prosecute them to a greater extent. So I know it's been a big issue, again, with the imports. I don't think much of it's being manufactured in the U.S., other than the pharmaceutical, which, again, is patches and those kinds of things. Yeah.
Okay.
So, co-chairs and Representative Buehler, I think that this is one of the key roles that the State Health Department's role for the community plays. It's that careful surveillance and to make sure that we really understand what is happening here in Oregon and what are the trends. So this is an example, and I think we've had a couple of other examples where other parts of the country have had much higher rates of problems that get a lot of national attention. And then what we have to do is make sure that our providers and our communities understand what exactly is happening here in Oregon through our Oregon data, but also that we are, you know, aware and are tracking these things prospectively mm-hmm. to see if trends are changing. So we always look at, you know, are we getting better, but also are things going in the wrong direction, and what do we need to do to intersect that immediately? And that's a key role, I think, of the surveillance and data functions of the public health division.
Yeah, and just so the committee knows, we have about 25 slides that we have to get through in about 50 to 60 minutes. So bear with us. There may be some follow-up that we may need to do in committee or offline, but just kind of bear with us as we'll probably go through these slides a little bit quicker than normal.
We are totally available, Representative Rayfield, at any time, individually and as a group.
And thank you for being patient with our limited time.
Okay. This is an example of what we talked about yesterday. This is one of our success stories, our fully vaccinated two-year-olds in Oregon. So we don't need to, I don't think, keep going about that. Okay. Communicable diseases, just quickly, we've talked, and I know this committee and the healthcare committee have spoken a lot about the role of dealing with the population in Oregon with hepatitis C and who has it and how we can both treat it and prevent it. But I just want to point out, we have over 300 and close to 400 reportable diseases in Oregon. And our acute and communicable disease unit follows those up, tracks them. Our public health lab takes things from, like, Peace Health or Good Samaritan, you know, when we need to understand exactly, you know, what is the bug and what is the DNA of the bug and how we can best control it. So that is one of our core functions in public health. Foodborne illness, hospital-acquired infection, sexually transmitted diseases, these are all on the front lines of protecting and containing any problems that we have. So moving right along. So this slide is a graphic representation of where we are going for the future. Public health modernization, I know you've all heard about. It began House Bill 3100, which was passed in the last legislative session, which was the result of a nine-month process of a legislatively convened task force that said, let's look at public health in Oregon. What are we doing? How are we doing it? But what has changed over the last 150 years, and how can we better address the needs of Oregonians? And the graphic that you see has foundational capabilities in the bottom box, and then those charts up on the top are what we call foundational programs. And this is kind of a national consensus of what governmental public health should be doing. You know, lots of people participate in protecting the public's health and working, particularly our partners in the nonprofit sector and community-based organizations. But this is looking just at what should governmental public health do kind of as its covenant with its citizens. And the actions that we've taken since then is we have established a public health advisory board, and the governor appointed the members, and they have been meeting for the last year since January of 2016. They've also called upon us to complete a statewide assessment of the current state. And that was completed and turned in with a lot of really great cooperation. Every single county, every single program throughout the state, as well as the state health department, went through this. So we have a really good understanding of where our gaps are, where our best work is being done, and also geographically. And I just want to say that even though we do have a lot of gaps in these foundational capabilities across the state, it's very uneven. It doesn't necessarily mean that for all of those elements,
improvements. It isn't the biggest counties that are necessarily doing the best in all of the work. And some of our frontier and smaller counties are doing an excellent job in the foundational capabilities with very little financial support. So a lot of it is how you think about it, how you organize it, and how you cooperate among your peers and also with the state. What's the role of the state and what's the role of the locals? And our last deliverable was this end of December. We turned in, if that's our plan and we saw our assessment, how would we go forward? And we have an implementation plan for public health modernization that was submitted in the end of December of 2016. So our next stages are fulfilling the requirements for accountability and metrics. And there is a subcommittee, the Public Health Advisory Board, working on that. And to the best of our ability with our key performance measures and with the gaps, we're trying to align those with the CCO incentive measures. And then our other deliverable is what we call funding formula. Like, how do we look at the gaps? How do we look at what is needed across the state and decide the best way to leverage resources to achieve the goals called upon that the epidemiology tells us the residents need? So I know you're aware of, this is a budget crisis all around, and I just want you to all know we know this too, and for the record, I just also want to say that we are definitely committed to moving ahead on this work to the extent that we are capable of. We really feel that Oregonians deserve it. We feel that we have really good strategic directions for this work and good understanding across the state. Our goal is to leverage the work that's being done, but also leverage the resources to whatever extent is possible to achieve that.
Please, Senator Steinberg.
Thank you. If we were to invest in the ways that I think I certainly agree that we should invest in modernizing our public health system, in 5 years or 10 years, how will we know we've succeeded?
So we're taking accountability and metrics extremely seriously, and it's not activities. I mean, that's one of the things that we have to really be honest about. There's a lot of good things you could do. I think yesterday when I was saying there's 100 things we could do, for chronic diseases, 50 of them are evidence-based, and 2 of them give you the biggest bang for your buck. And I think that's what we're going to have to hold ourselves accountable to. I think we should work with our partners, particularly our contractors, and really, come to some agreement on what are the measurements and in our contracting process that will show if the work is being done. But I personally believe that we can do this. I also am very committed to the fact that it's, contracts shouldn't be a stick. They should be a carrot. We should sit down and be able to say, I know you want this for your community. I want this for my community. If we're not getting the results, let's get together and decide how we should use the resources and what we should be investing in. And I think that's part of the modernization. That's a new way of having these relationships.
Thank you. Yesterday you alluded to you mentioned explicitly the fact that you now have MOUs with different agencies to talk about sharing. Is it fair to assume that this model also incorporates a lot more cross-agency work and leveraging of the strengths? I mean, to me, this seems fundamental to getting our kids well-educated, for example.
Absolutely. I mean, yes. again, I could use the whole time up, Representative Rayfield, and I'm trying to be respectful of your request. But, that's part of, who's at the table, what are they doing, who has that core function, who should be doing what, but let's get agreement on what we're trying to achieve for Oregonians in terms of, the outcomes that we're looking for. And to just be really honest, if we all wanted this, well, if we're not getting it, let's all get back to the drawing board. I think we have CCOs involved, hospitals and health systems. We know that a lot of the primary care practices that have gone to the team-based model, they are all working as partners in doing this, and we have to be really very disciplined about who's doing what and follow the money, but also keep us really tight to our accountability measures.
If I could just comment on this as well, with our state health improvement plan, and we've gone through the seven priority areas, but when we talk about the activities in each of those, they're in three large buckets. One of them is to improve overall population health, and we can look at outcomes. But the two other buckets of interventions that we're looking at are activities. One of them is how well we're working with health systems to drive this. So again, that's that cross-sectoral. And then the third large category is around health equity, to make sure that we're addressing populations that are disproportionately affected by certain. So that's within our state health improvement plan, but that really supports this idea with modernization. I think we modernize the public health system, but it really is that we need everybody to help us do the work of improving, improving the health of Oregonians. It isn't just the public health system that does it. We really do need to reach out to other partners.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Hedberg was reminding me, we also have done, as part of this work, a return on investment report, looking at how can we extract from what is known evidence nationally to our numbers here in Oregon, and what can we expect if we invest in some of these prevention? And that, again, you know, we can give you the link to that as well.
That would be very helpful. Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I may. Colleagues, you know, this is what public agencies are supposed to do. They leverage tiny amounts of funding. Tiny. We dramatically underfund public health in this state. Dramatically underfund. And yet they hold themselves accountable to very aggressive KPMs that actually have direct outcomes on people's lives, that are not indirect in the slightest. They hold themselves accountable for evidence-based standards and using evidence-based policies. They actually calculate ROI and publish that information so that we can tell that they're using taxpayer dollars wisely. And everything that they do saves the state money in the long term. It just...
Are you suggesting that we invest in their modernization? Yeah, and where are you going to find the dollars?
I'm working on it. I'm working hard.
I have another suggestion.
Please.
Maybe have more agency heads have degrees in public health and less law degrees.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be lovely.
That's your way off subject.
So that we're actually data-driven instead of rhetoric-driven. Wouldn't that be nice?
It would be lovely, fellow doctor on the panel. No, I'm really serious, colleagues.
I'm
we're
totally
talking about
serious.
Government efficiency, and we're talking about cost efficiency, and we're talking about cost savings. We ought to be looking to the public health division as a model of how to do an awful lot with not very much, and hold yourself accountable and be very transparent about it.
I totally agree.
Thank you. Working on it.
So, Representative Rayfield, Senator Steiner, hey, we co-chairs. I think we're getting into
the good co-chair over here.
Sorry.
35 minutes, 15 slots.
Okay.
I'll be quiet.
Deep breath.
I'll pack away my soapbox.
Me too.
So, co-chairs, Representative Rayfield, to Senator Steiner Haywood's last point. Now we're getting into our division budget and by fund type, and I want to encourage Karen Slothauer to jump in if I misspeak on anything here. But this slide, I'd like you to look at carefully. We have a lot of background that we'll go through for different areas. But this is the overview. And as you can see, of our $648 million, a huge percentage, actually 58% of it, is from the federal funds. And an example, you know, the reason we have that dark blue, and what color is it showing up, kind of a mustard color. color is. Those are all federal funds, but what's really important to understand is that those mustard-colored funds, that is all the Woman, Infant, and Children's Nutrition Program. So that comes from the Department of Agriculture, and that there's, you know, very strict, we won't get into WIC and what you can buy with it or not. It's much more disciplined than the food stamp, the SNAP program, but we can talk about that another time. But a couple things. Only 7% of this budget comes from the state general fund. And then the other funds are example of that are our fees, money that we get. What does it buy? Some of it buys services and drugs for HIV, special funds that come from the feds. And then the 7% that you have of our FTEs really funds about 55 of our FTEs overall. And I'm not being an alarmist. I believe that we can manage ourselves through whatever comes down the pike. But I think a couple things that are important. You're all aware of the discussions around the changes in the Affordable Care Act. There's a little known part of the Affordable Care Act, which is like just budget dust compared to the big issues that need to be resolved in any kind of replacement or reform of the Affordable Care Act, and that's the Public Health Prevention and Wellness Fund. And so this is the environment we're in is extremely unstable. So that's why I say I'm not trying to be an alarmist. We will manage to it. 2 days ago, you know, we had some information that in some of the Congress's proposals, it was not there. It was eliminated. And then what's today? Thursday, Tuesday, I received information that in what some of the Congress staffers had sent to the Office of Management and Budget to look at for what would they cost out some of these changes, we did have the Prevention and Wellness Trust Fund up until 2019. So that was there, you know, for this year, half of this year, and our fiscal year here in the state and the next fiscal year. And that's a total of $10 million that comes to the state of Oregon through that. It's close to $1 billion overall, but it's $10 million to our state. So, like, last Friday, it wasn't there, you know, this Friday. So we're not, you know, we are managing to any type of eventuality that comes down the road. And I think that that's important. We pulled out the WIC money because sometimes it's just put into our federal funding. What the Department of Agriculture and the Congress does with those, you know, that'll either be there or won't be there, you know, and we're monitoring all of that. But I just want to assure you that we are trying to weekly figure out, you know, what does this mean? This morning, you probably heard that the Environmental Protection Agency is cutting out dollars for beach monitoring. And that in our state, it's a little under $300,000 total that we get for this. Now, you know, in Congress, it's like here, you know, it's not over till it's over. You know, you have the budget and then you have the negotiations. And often these things are not in the initial, the initial go round. But, you know, this isn't a normal year, and I think that we have to be prepared. We might not have those EPA dollars, and what are we going to do? And what is the way that we can leverage what we have, work with our partners, and figure out what Oregonians want us to prioritize? So those are some of our challenges going forward. And you saw that, you know, we know when we invest upstream, like in tobacco, those tobacco dollars have made a huge difference, you know, in Oregonians' lives. So, you know, I guess I wouldn't be honest if I just went through the budget and said, it's all set in stone and it's predictable. It's not predictable. We don't know. I'll know more again tomorrow. I have a Friday call every single week with all of my colleagues around the country who are in similar positions in the other 50 states and territories. So with that, we can tell you what we do now. Okay. So this is what... these are
one question, Mr. Chair, just very quickly. How much of the funding that you have is passed through to
next
your county?
Slide. Okay. No, this one, general fund? Okay. So Our pass-through funding is a term that we use to describe scenarios where we get the money from a grantor, but we distribute it to our business partners. Over 60% of the money that comes into the Public Health Division's state general fund budget is pass-through funding, and a high percentage of all of our federal funding and grants also go out to communities.
Follow up. Can you provide us with the percentage that actually pass through to counties and the percentage those fundings that go, whether it's competitive grants or go to nonprofits and what have you in the communities? Can you do that?
Go ahead, Karen.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Karen Slothauer, and I'm the fiscal officer for the Public Health Division. Senator Winters, we do have a slide coming forward that talks about our pass-through in total, the total for the Public Health Division of all funds. We may have to get detailed information for you on the amount that's passed through directly to counties. The way we have this broken out is to all pass through to all entities at this point in time. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, but the majority of all of the pass-through funding does go to our counties. Yeah. Okay. So let's see where we're going here. So total funds by service area. We have a way of organizing work in public health nationally. We talk about we have prevention, we have protection, and we have... Practice, which is the communicable disease work, the lab work. And this just shows you of the total dollars that we have, how that is applied across the area of public health responsibilities. So let's see. And then we can just, if you are interested in more detail, we do have slides for every single area and how that works out. So, if there's anything you want to highlight, Karen, as we go through. Okay. I am watching the clock. Okay. So if there's any particular questions that you have, co-chairs and members of the committee, we can just, go through the slides. Okay. So I want to get to, this is the slide, Senator Winters, that we put together to look at our authorized pass through, how much is authorized on the state budget level, and what that work is doing, and where it's broken down. So we'll just pause for a minute if anybody has any questions on this.
Please, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rayfield. Are you dealing with any shifting or rebalancing of funding on the federal side from the previous biennium? Meaning under the small budget deficit that you talked about in the ACA, is there any shifting or change in that yet?
Not that we've been notified of. I can say that. Not there may be, but we haven't been notified of anything.
Okay.
Okay. So one of the things that has. Oh, okay. Moving right along. Okay. 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 24 doesn't show up. Okay. One of the guidance that we got is that the committee would like to look at, kind of what are our risks, what are our drivers, and what is our environment. And we've outlined here that, and we have a lot of them, obviously, in the unsettled environment that we're in and trying to respond to other factors that affect our partners. But the biggest things that we're looking at is our categorical federal funding, 57% of our budget. That's a lot. It's also a lot of support for the locals. There's specific work plans associated with these grants. Very often we can't shift the dollars, you know, to another outcome because it's very, there's a very specific deliverable that, that our funder is expecting us to participate in and show how this has been influencing health outcomes here in Oregon. Then we also have to align with our highest needs. Our healthcare system changes are another big driver. With 93 to 95% of all Oregons insured, we no longer need to operate as a safety net, and we're still working with that transition with a lot of our local public health departments. We do know that you know, things might change, but it's like, where are the partners going forward with our modernized vision? Do we, you know, how do we continue to modernize? Also understanding how do we get others to participate in taking care of the most vulnerable among us if there are changes in eligibility. And population increases. Oregon's rising population does present a challenge for the public health. When we were looking, when we were preparing our slides to present to the committee, some of the things that we saw, this doesn't seem to be going down, but it looks like the per capita is going down, but the prevalence is going up. And we realized, well, you know, there's more people than the last time we looked at it, you know. So really making sure we follow where the population changes are so we can know give technical assistance and advice to what those outcomes might be changing as, you know, people's populations and counties' populations change. Our biggest risk, obviously, is our uncertainty of federal funds for 17-19. We feel that we are well positioned because we have done our modernization work. We've identified what is directionally correct with our partners. We have agreement with our assessment. So we feel that we will have a data-driven decision process, and we have that data collected that is transparent and that people can see why we're making the decisions that we may have to make in the future.
Senator Winters.
Just a question, and rather than, and certainly there is uncertainty. There's uncertainty every time we have administrative changes, and every time we have revenue changes. But I, you know, you're talking 17-19, and given the how long it takes for Congress to act and get things through the process, don't you think that 19-21 will probably be the biggest impact, or the biggest change?
Co-chairs, Senator Winters, I don't have a crystal ball.
That's why
I'm preparing for the worst and hoping for the best.
Can we allocate funding for one of those?
Ms. Ames told us we couldn't allocate that pop. They put up a pop in the budget for crystal balls.
Could we go with
the tight fiscal times?
That's
actually true. Maybe we could have them modify it.
I think we could do that.
But just knowing that the amount of time that it actually takes from one, even in this building, from one change to the next, as we prepare, and of course we've got to prepare, but, my sense tells me of having been around here for so long that probably the greater piece will be what happens 1921. Because of the time that it takes in order to get things through Congress. And for even, administratively. Mm-hmm. So granted, you need to plan for 17-19, but I think the big plan comes 19-21. Just my little sense.
Co-chair, Senator Winters, I think that's a lot of wisdom in what you've said, that we always have to be looking at the horizon and understanding that there's pacing involved. We will probably in 17-19 mm-hmm. really get a sense of the direction that that we're headed in. Yeah.
Yes.
So we've listed the
go ahead.
The risk. We have a couple of funny ways that we get funded, and one is the legislature did a number of things to support public health a couple of years ago by dedicating revenue from medical marijuana to core public health programs. And again, I just want to just call out, we have declining medical marijuana revenue since we've had legalized recreational marijuana. And the trend, and I'm told by Karen, is about 17%. We're already seeing a 17% decline in the revenue. And they that those dollars in public health fund very core programs like drinking water, our drinking water program. And then, again, you know, whether we have reduced funding coming through, if 60% of our funding goes out to the locals, obviously this is going to impact local counties and their budgets. And then our environmental factors, we've already really talked a lot about that. The emerging infectious diseases is really something that we just started planning for. We've always had surveillance and response, but I would say 4 or 5 years ago, after H1N1, I guess it was a little longer, we really understood that these are going to be regular events that will come from, you know, left field, and we just have to have that infrastructure ready to respond regardless of what the emerging infectious disease is. And obviously, we're very sensitive to, like, the zoonotic diseases that are going from animals to humans, and we've had our state veterinarian is working very closely with the veterinary community as well as the infectious disease community to monitor all that, and we get regular worldwide notices of what's happening around the globe with that to prepare. So all of those are kind of new public health techniques or new public health activities or old ones that have come, you know, back to the fore, and we've been investing in them. I don't know if you want to, in the budget we have currently, we do have a total of about $18.4 million estimated in our total budget that does come from the marijuana program. So that is a major risk for us. So these are additions to our programs since we last spent time with you. We also have reductions that have, you know, happened in the last couple of years, the per capita to local public health and the C-Care, both C-Care, family planning, and the breast and cervical canceling are adjusted to fund the current activities that we see post-healthcare transformation and expansion of Medicaid for those programs. Major changes.
Sorry, really quick question about that. So, in theory, funding adjustments for C-Care and BCCP should be neutral because you're not providing the service anymore. But that's not necessarily true because some of that provides necessary. I mean, you always have a need for some level of infrastructure. So is that balancing out, or are you behind the eight ball on that because you're losing enough funds to fund the core infrastructure?
Co-chairs and members of the committee, at this point in time, we are in balance and slightly ahead in the C-Care program. So we have been able to maintain that core infrastructure.
Okay.
So major program changes in the last year to the public health department. A lot of this has been the new work of leveraging with other agencies, but also making sure that we have the most efficient and effective structure in public health to deliver the services. So there's been some consolidation. The Oregon Health Licensing Office, the Care Assist, and the Substance Abuse and Tobacco Prevention Transfer. Again, that's Oregon Health Authority making sure that we have the most efficient and effective structure to deliver these programs. Our governor's budget, House Bill 5027, has investments in public health. And, you know, you were going to have you're going to have an opportunity to talk about the DEQ POP and its impact on public health. The governor has put in a request to increase the price of cigarettes to 85 cents. We know that that will specifically target, help us deal with the reduction in the youth uptake. We know that if you don't start smoking before you're 21 or 24, you probably won't start smoking. So that's a really high priority for us for prevention. And, yeah.
If I could just add one comment to that. One of the things about tobacco, I was going to say it's the good news, but because we have declining sales, we've actually had fewer tax revenues, so that's part of it. But we also know if you increase the price of tobacco, it's called price elasticity, you actually have fewer people use. So in some ways, like I say, declining revenue is good news. Fewer people are smoking. At the same time, making sure that tobacco and other, if you will, some of these vices cost more is a way to decrease their use, which again is a public health priority. So, anyway.
Okay. And the governor's budget also includes other fund increases to allow us to continue to support the services that we are currently providing and have been required of the Public Health Division. We are also looking at and have submitted a budget that includes administrative reductions. We will be holding all of our general fund positions vacant, and we are reducing travel and training and other services and supplies, and we're evaluating ways to continue these administrative streamlined areas and structures.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, are you going to speak more about the fees? Because if you weren't, then I wanted to say a couple things.
I did. I have my eye on the clock.
I want members to be aware, because I know it, okaying fee increases is a big responsibility, and members want to understand what they're doing. So just in terms of technical structure, I wanted to be clear. House Bill 5027 is the fee ratification bill, so that's just ratifying fees they've already increased administratively during the interim.
That is a question about that.
Senator Gelzer.
So you mentioned that yesterday, and I went home and puzzled about it. So an agency raises fees, they implement it, and then we retroactively vote on it later?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Which I think is bad.
And Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, it used to be that the trouble is you had 2 years until you could go back in and ask for a new fee increase, and it was it allowed the agency to deal with sort of unexpected circumstances administratively.
But what
it doesn't happen
if we vote
that
no.
much.
So say it's already implemented, they come back, legislature disagrees, do they have to refund all of the fees? Does their budget not balance? What's the purpose of?
They certainly have to quit assessing the fee. I don't actually know how much they have to refund.
And to That's be clear, this question. Isn't about any fee. It's just mechanically that the process doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
But it is statute.
Statute always makes sense.
Yeah. So,
sure,
now
Senator,
that we and now that we have annual sessions, it's much less of an issue. But I did want to point out only two of these fees in the third bullet are actually in the fee ratification bill. That's the lab accreditation program and the Toxic Free Kids Act. So the lab accreditation program, they were trying to figure out how do we incorporate the marijuana lab work into that fee structure. They tried to get it ready and through the public process by last session, February, but were not able to get through it. It turned out to be very complicated, and when you look at the bill, you will understand, perhaps. The Toxic Free Kids Act was a new program that they were asked to do, and they're just now getting through that fee process. The rest of these fees are new fees that they're proposing to increase next biennium, which is the process we all like better, where you talk about it ahead. If the legislature approves these fees, they've been discussed here, they're part of their budget, then they don't have to come back next time with a fee ratification bill because they've already been approved.
So, co-chairs, if you would like any specific questions, we can around the detail or the why, I guess, for the fee.
Okay. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rayfield. I would be remiss if I didn't ask on dental sealants, good program. I noticed that the data that you're presenting on page 10 predates any of the metrics back to the 2012. We didn't start those in the CCOs until 2015. So first question is, why are we looking at five-year-old data? And the second is, are you looking at, under dental sealants, dentists are required to use a hydrophobic material only, a category of material, which does not like water, does not bond in water. And you, as you can imagine, if you have moisture on a tooth with a child that is not 100% cooperative, you can't get a sealant on that child. Yet we have dental materials that are hydrophilic that like water and that will bond and create that sealant, but we're not allowed to use them. So I think some modernization of the concepts of putting specific materials or classified materials into requirements to try and achieve goals might be a little outdated or needs to be modernized quicker or changed to use of appropriate material. So we run into that in healthcare quite a bit where we got, hey, here's the greatest thing of the day, but 2 years later, in this case 5 years later, the greatest thing of the day with technology is no longer the greatest thing of the day. So I just want to bring that to the attention that the data is old, sealants 2015 are now part of what the CCOs are pushing and increasing 10% each year, and that the materials that we are allowed to use are restricted. So we're hoping to change some of that.
So, co-chairs, Representative Hayden. So, just it harkens back to the discussion we had yesterday about the source of the data. These data come from what's called the SMILE survey, which is done in select schools around the state, where they go in and because the 6 to 9 year olds aren't actually how to put this, they're not the ones who are giving us information. This involves an exam where people go, hygienists and others go in to look at kids' teeth. So, other things that are part of this survey include any dental caries, rampant caries, those kinds of things, and the presence of dental sealants. What you are alluding to, of course, has to do with service delivery, etc. We can get those data to you. We actually have our oral health program in public health, but it's a joint program with the Office of Health Policy and Analytics with the other, well, another branch of OHA, and Dr. Bruce Austin, of course, is the Oregon Dental Health Director, who's looking at a number of these things, again, across the agency. So we can get you more current data, to the extent that we have it. I'm not familiar with the delivery data around dental sealants, but again, these data come very specifically from that SMILE survey. We don't have the resources to do that. You can see it's done every 5 years. To do it more frequently than every 5 years, it gets back to actually collecting data cost money. We do intend, to the extent possible, to continue to look again at the status of oral health in school kids to the extent that we have funding. But and to your point, we will get some data about what has been delivered within the DCOs.
And co-chairs and Representative Hayden, and I will definitely get Dr. Austin to answer the question about what the constraints are around what the recommendations are for use. Right. Which type?
Well, it looks like that kind of gets us through the slides in it faster than I was anticipating, so thank you guys very much. But I also think that gives us about 10 minutes, which would make sense to probably go through the fee bill since we have a little time, because that is something we'll be voting on. I think that's something people may have questions on.
And Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, there is the written testimony of the detail here of what she's going to tell you posted under today's date.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, once again, I'm Lillian Shirley, and I'm delighted to have our content experts here with me today to deliver the not just the content, but the rationale behind where we are and what we need to do to move forward in these two areas. Colette Young, who is the center director for our practice area, which includes immunization, acute and communicable diseases, the public health lab, all those good things like hospital-acquired infections, and Gabrielle Goldfarb, who we're very excited, joined us recently to be the manager of our environmental health section, and brings a lot of understanding with all of our partners in the state who are working on environmental issues as well. So another way that we're streamlining our thinking and our ability to come to conclusions together across the state.
Good morning. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Colette Young. I administrate the Center for Public Health Practice, and I'm here with Gabrielle Goldfarb to talk to you about fee ratifications in House Bill 5027. The first set of fees for ratification is the Oregon Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program. We fondly call it ORLAP. And then we'll talk about the Toxic Free Kids Act fees. In June 2016, ORLAP application and field of accreditation fees were increased by 20% for out-of-state labs, and a new tier of testing complexity, advanced technology, was added to the list of ORLAP fees for both in-state and out-of-state labs. The advanced technology fees accommodate the accreditation of highly complex technologies, including in-state cannabis testing laboratories that test for pesticides and solvent residue. The criteria for designation as an advanced technology field of accreditation include the level of technologic complexity listed in the fields of accreditation, the amount of time required for rigorous evaluation of raw data and documentation, and the complexity for the on-site assessment. Based on this criteria, some technologies have moved to a higher level of field of accreditation for both in-state and out-of-state labs. ORLAP, as a reminder, does not accredit out-of-state labs for cannabis testing. ORLAP accredits out-of-state laboratories that test drinking water samples for Oregon water systems, and it tests samples for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, where there is not in-state accredited laboratory capacity or the expertise needed to do the business with Oregon companies. The fee changes support policy option package 409. Fee ratification is needed to ensure that the program has sufficient funds to continue accrediting laboratories. The fee ratification will generate an estimated $262,000 in additional fees for ORLAP during the 17-19 biennium. The additional fees will help support the two positions that were authorized by 15-17 Policy Option Package 501 for cannabis testing laboratory accreditation. If the fee changes are not ratified, the program won't be able to continue to credit all the laboratories that it currently accredits, potentially jeopardizing the ability to have drinking water and cannabis testing as required by statute. Out-of-laboratory accreditation fees have not been increased since 2011, and we've seen no opposition to the 20% increase. Oregon laboratory accreditation fees haven't been increased since 2002 and are not increased by this fee change. New fees were established for Oregon laboratories for accreditation for advanced technologies and to enable cannabis testing laboratories to test for pesticide and solvent residue as required by ORS 475B.555 and pursuant to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission licensure.
So before we move on to the Toxic Free Kids Act, are there any questions?
I have one. Just in looking at fees, you know, when we're looking at the accreditation fees haven't been increased since 2002. I mean, there's a thing called inflation. So I'm curious how you sustain kind of the budget. You know, and I assume that the fees are supposed to completely support this program. So I'm kind of curious how you've been able to get away for so long without coming back asking to increase those fees.
Thank you for the question, Representative Co-Chair. Yes. It has been a challenge, and it is safe to say that we have leveraged every resource at the state public health lab to support environmental lab accreditation, both for cannabis and drinking water. So we are now at a point where we're rectifying a much needed issue.
Okay. Is there any general fund that's going to support any of this lab?
No, there is general fund supporting the lab, but not supporting ORLAP in particular.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yes, Representative Bueller.
Yeah, great job. Could you use your process and leverage that to other agencies in Oregon State Government? Learn best practices? You don't have to answer that.
Thank you.
I don't think that was a question.
Just having fun. All right, so we'll move on to the Toxic Free Kids Act.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Rayfield, Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward. I'm Gabriella Goldfarb, manager of the Environmental Public Health Section at the Oregon Health Authority. For a couple of you, you may have a vague recollection of me. I joined OHA in September. Prior to that, I was a policy advisor, natural resources policy advisor in the governor's office. So I interacted with some of you in that capacity. Today, I'm happy to come before you to talk about the fee bill that ratifies fees for the Toxic Free Kids Act. And that is a legislation that this body enacted in 2015 that is similar to a program, but goes a little bit farther than a program in Washington State that requires manufacturers that gross over $5 million a year, so that is the in sales, that is the regulated community, to report whether there are whether any of their children's products or a certain set of children's products contain one or more of 66 chemicals. Again, this is the same list that's used in Washington State. That may be toxic to children, and they have to first report that, and then in the future they will be, and this is where we go beyond Washington State, they will be required to remove those substances. There is also a process for a waiver. There are two waiver processes. There's one up front that allows them to demonstrate from the get-go that they don't have any of these substances and get out of the program altogether. And then later on, there's a waiver process if they can demonstrate that that there is no feasible alternative, less toxic alternative, and that the product would be compromised. There is a way to consider issuing them a waiver later in this program. So the cost to OHA to implement TFK, it's a little bit tough to estimate. Our program is not exactly the same as Washington's, and our requirements are a little bit different. So our best estimate is that will cost $480,000 per year. The legislature did appropriate just over $87,000 for the 15-17 biennium to launch the program. OHA's requested $229,389 for the 17-19 biennium, and the balance that we need to implement this program will come in the form of fees that are paid by manufacturers, again, who gross over $5 million in global sales annually. So that's a little more precise description of who the regulated community is. The fees, these fees went into effect February 1st. We concluded the RAC process for fees in December and went out to public comment, and they took effect on February 1st. I have more detail over about those fees. If you have questions, there are some that are non-refundable that have to do with, you know, just registering your product, and there's some that would be refundable if you want to go through one of these waiver processes. So I'm happy to provide more detail if there are questions.
But this was extremely controversial, my question is, whether you had in posting the fee, and you said there was public comment. Can you share those public comments with us?
So I don't believe we received any. Co-chairs and Senator Winters.
And did you receive any comment from the industry that would be affected?
Thank you for that question. So we did not receive any public comment, to my knowledge. I will circle back and clarify if that's incorrect, but that's my recollection. I will share with you the participants in the Rulemaking Advisory Committee included representatives from Target, Walmart, the Toy Industry Association, Associated Oregon Industries, the Oregon Environmental Council, and another state that's interested in this, Vermont Department of Health.
Would you share those with us? You don't have to do it today, but this was so controversial when this went through, and it wasn't really bipartisan when it went through this building. So for me, and we're talking about, you know, ratifying a fee, so before I give you a vote, I want to know what happened in this. We were just talking on the side, you know, when this whole ratification process started, it was when we were doing every 2 years. We are no longer doing every 2 years. We're doing annual. I agree with my colleague, Senator Geltzer. This is probably the most backward way of doing increases to an agency's budget when we're doing it after the fact. So I would, if you can do it offline, but I would like to have some further conversation with you about this one.
Thank you, Senators and Co-Chairs and Senator Winters. Just to clarify, I didn't want to imply that there was no public comment on the program, on the rules for the program itself, but rather on just the fee part of it, which was done a little bit separately than the
That's
development
my point.
Of the program. Mm-hmm. So
it's always the dollars.
Yeah, and just as obviously the co-chair and myself are kind of like projecting into the next biennium and things like that as we kind of plan for these things. And I just, you know, the general fund has increased naturally as it would, right, as you're implementing into the next session. Mm-hmm. So that's something we would have anticipated. The one thing I remember is that the program was going to continue to ramp up. And so one of the questions that I have is, what's going to be the estimated ramp up in the next biennium? Then the next question is, are we going to be able to, because you've had this discussion with all of the stakeholders, are we going to be able to, depending on what that ramp up is, how much of the fees will be able to absorb the ramp up in the next biennium versus the pushback you may have, nobody likes paying fees, right? So I'm assuming there was some pushback.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just kind of curious about that dynamic as we project into the next bienniums.
So Chair Rayfield and Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, thank you for that question. The fees that we have proposed are intended to carry the needs of the program for three biennia. Yes,
okay.
Because we anticipate that there is the ramp up, but once manufacturers have gone through the process, while there is an ability to add chemicals, there's a limit on how many and how quickly those can be added. I think it's five chemicals or three chemicals every 5 years or five every three. I can look up the details. And if you know, three chemicals every 5 years. You know, there's going to be a big flush of work, and then it will be done. So we don't imagine that the program will continue to ramp up indefinitely. That it will really level off and then be pretty stable.
In the next biennium, will we see an increased investment of need for general fund or anything like that coming into the next biennium?
We should not.
Okay.
The way that it's structured is we needed the general fund to start the program. It's very, very challenging technically, but that the fees would really support the program over time.
Okay. Perfect. We're just trying to identify cost drivers, so yep. I saw the increase and thought I'd ask.
Good question.
Any other questions? Representative Malmstrom, are you sure?
Yeah, I feel lonely down here.
Lonely Representative Malmstrom.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Gelser, my favorite senator.
Yes, my favorite representative. I've been told that I missed the most important part of the hearing, and the good senator to the left has said I must.
See, you notice that, don't you?
Oh,
right,
pay tribute.
Left.
Wow.
I must pay tribute. So, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear.
Dan
Rayfield, happy birthday to you.
Thank you. That was very nice. Very nice. So, and thank you to the good co-chair and everyone for being so overly nice for the birthday stuff.
Overly nice. I consider it thoughtful. Only your due.
Extremely thoughtful.
We actually
extremely
like
thoughtful.
You. We do.
So.
We like
a lot.
You. We really like you.
See, I thought that's why we all ran for office, was so that people have to pay compliments to us.
No.
It doesn't work that way.
Okay. All
right.
Have you discovered that yet?
Okay. All right. Anyway, thanks for putting up with us. I appreciate it. We'll, Ms. Ames, is there anything before we close off? You're horrified by this conversation.
Mr. Chair, OHA will continue on Monday. With central services and statewide assessments.
And we'll be back in hearing room F.
And right, we'll be back home.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, co-chairs, for this opportunity. Go ahead and hear.